This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Chapter 6. And the issues here revolve around or touch on something that we've spoken about very briefly previously, but we'll speak about in much greater depth this evening, and that I was stimulated to think on in some discussions I was having with Rabbi Pogros, who's here outside. He was saying to me, very hard to sell the Monday night shoe. I said, why is it hard to sell the Monday night shoe? He said, well, people work their tire. They're willing to come for fun and entertainment, but not to a heavy shoe. And, you know, to get something out of the Monday night shoe, you need to think. And people don't want to think on a Monday night. They don't want to invest any kind of effort on a Monday night. So if we can supply them with fun and entertainment and some jokes and some good food, they'll come. And so this set me thinking and saying, you know, if we dish out free motor cars, they'll come. If we dish out free scotch, they'll come. There are ways to create easy sales. There are ways. Rabbi Pogra, I'm talking about you. So, and it's Rosh Hashanah, so you should come and listen and enjoy it like everybody else. So I'm trying to figure out, is Torah an easy sell, and should it be an easy sell? And if it isn't an easy sell, then what? And I've been mulling all this over in my mind a little bit. I find, firstly, that other religions are an easy sell. They are. Other religions are all quite an easy sell, and the numbers tell the story. We're the oldest and we're the smallest. We've been going the longest, we originated, we were the innovators, and we're the smallest. We are the wisest, and we're the smallest. We have the biggest body of knowledge, we offer the most solutions, and we're the smallest. We have the most festivals, and we're the smallest. We're good at business, we make money, and we're the smallest. We excel in all the professions, and we're the smallest. You must say that for some reason this isn't an easy sell. The other religions, Christianity starts, 1,000 years after us, and within decades, a few hundred years, they've got millions of followers. Easy sell. And so with all the other religions. Look at what's happening with the Muslims. Easy sell. We don't have an easy sell. And part of this easy sell question was what motivated the rise of Hasidism. The Baal Shem Tov very simply said in his day, it's a hard sell. We need to change it. We need to present it in a way that is more accessible to people, that is easier for people. And then started the big controversy, or controversy as you say. The Vilna Gaon saying, this is the beginning of the end. You're starting to accommodate, you're starting to turn truth into a marketing exercise. Truth is not an easy sell. And the moment you try to market truth, you've lost it. Because marketing requires illusion. Marketing requires, because if it's so attractive that it doesn't require illusion, then it doesn't require marketing. The fact that it requires marketing means it's not so attractive. That's what it means. If it was that attractive, you wouldn't need to advertise it. Everybody would be lining up. The mere fact that you need to market a product or a service means that you need illusion in order to gear it, in order to mass market it. There might be individuals who would take it in any case, but if you want the masses to follow, you've got to introduce illusion. And the Vilna Gaon was enormously concerned that the tendency that Hasidism was introducing ran the risk of introducing a degree of illusion and distorting reality and distorting truth. The Telzerov writes that he was under enormous pressure at some time in Telz. Telz Yeshiva was the gem of Lithuanian learning. There were a few yeshivas like that, but Telz was one of them. The seat of intellect of Lithuania. Lithuania was the seat of intellect of world Jewry, and the seat of intellect of learning and of lombus, of deep learning. The school of Higoyim, the whole philosophic learning school, originated there. Telz yeshiva produced the leadership of the entire world, of the Jewish world. Telz yeshiva. How many students were there in Telz yeshiva? About 150, I think. Another yeshiva opened in Telz and started advertising, and within weeks they had hundreds of students and donors and supporters. And Telz is struggling along, and they've got an old building that's falling to pieces, and they're not finding it difficult to pay their teachers, and the Rosh Hashivas are struggling around trying to raise funds. And they came to the Telz Rav and they said, look what they're doing down the road. A little bit of marketing, a little bit of packaging, and look what you can produce. And he said, never, ever. We'd rather close our doors than do that. Because once you start the marketing process, once your effort is on the easy sell, there is inevitably a compromise on what you're selling in order to make it an easy sell. And we have to be very careful that on the one hand what we sell is accessible and attractive, but on the other hand there's no illusion to it. And Torah has never had illusion, and therefore it's never been popular. The fact that we don't have followers is not just because we don't proselytize. The reason that we don't have followers, we comfort ourselves by saying, you know why we're such a small religion? Because we don't proselytize. The reason we're such a small religion is because we cannot proselytize. Because it's just not attractive enough. It's just not an attractive religion for the ordinary man in the street. It's attractive to certain types of people, but they don't need to be proselytized. They get attracted in any case. But to attract people to it, very hard sell. Rabbi Pogler is right. Torah is a hard sell. It's easier to sell other religions. Why? Because other religions offer solutions, and we offer questions. Hard questions that don't have answers. Because we believe that when you have formulated the question, the individual can design his own solution. Whereas other religions believe that the way to control people is to give them solutions. And that's when it becomes cultist, and that's when it becomes controlling. And we've had it in our own religion too, and that was one of the things that Vilna Gaon was worried about a controlling element of a rebbe that controls a whole community in that particular way, providing solutions. Our rabbeim don't provide solutions, they help clarify the issues. And then you work out your own solutions. Recently in Auschwitz, somebody asked me a really touchy question that had political overtones and halakhic overtones, and was quite disturbed by my response, which was, there's a certain part of your question that has a halakhic element to it. This is the halakha, and as for the rest of it, do what you want. You don't have to ask me, do what you want. Yeah, but what should I do? Whatever you want. What do you recommend I do? I recommend you do what you want. People find that difficult because they come to religion very often for the comfort of being provided with solutions, and the belief that these solutions come from down high. They don't. God doesn't give solutions. And if somebody's giving you a solution, no, it's not from God. It's from a control freak who wants you to buy into his solutions so that you're dependent on him. God doesn't provide solutions. Go through the Gemara. Where do you find solutions? Do you find questions? Go through the Torah. Where do you find solutions? Do you find questions? You don't find solutions. Because God doesn't give solutions. God leaves us to work the solutions out and respects our solutions, provided they are worked out intelligently. He gives us the intelligence to work it out. He gives us the knowledge to work it out. He gives us the information to work it out. He gives us the methodology to work it out. And then he says, do your own work. Figure it out yourself. I mentioned in our last year, I mentioned my Rosh Hashiva in Kfar Hasidim, Rav Mishkovsky. And tonight we're very honored to have his nephew with us. I saw him after we started, Shalom Aleichem. That's the nephew of my Rosh Hashiva from Kfar Hasidim. Of David Mishkovsky's son. David used to visit, this is his son. But David couldn't come this year, his son is here instead. But one of the interesting things about him was that he would refuse to do our thinking for us. Whenever we would go to him with a problem, whether it was a problem in life, or a problem in learning, or a problem in law, in halacha, Rebbe Mishkovsky's response would always be, we'd say, what do you think? What should we do? response would be, what do you think you should do? How do you understand this? What answer would you draw from it? And then he would discuss. But only when we got to the point that we could go no further, then he would help us take it further. But never before then. Never would he intervene at the point where we had not yet done the basic thinking. Because our Torah facilitates the thinking process, it doesn't substitute the thinking process. And that's not an easy sell. It's easy to sell solutions. It's hard to sell the obligation and responsibility to figure out your own solutions. That isn't to say that the Torah is heavy in every way. It's a heavy religion, but it's an onerous religion. Not suggesting that at all. It isn't. There is in Torah an interesting interplay between awe and celebration. Between Kedusha, sanctity on the one hand, and Simcha, joy on the other hand. And the art is not to create a balance. People often say, it's a balance. Balance means taking something dynamic and turning it into something static. What you do, you put a board on a fulcrum and you work with it until you reach balance. So you're moving. When are you considered in balance? When the movement stops. The art of life is not to achieve balance. Balance is dull, boring, and static. The art is to achieve the management of the movement between the two poles. When you're not in a static place, you're not in one place all the time. You're moving, you're adapting, you're in the right place for that moment. But that means you need to be able to sense the two poles, you need to be able to sense the moment, and you need to be able to sense where you are, and to constantly make adjustments. That's the art of the management of paradox. And the Torah is all about paradox. All of it is about paradox. No solutions, just paradox, questions, problems, difficulties. And that creates the tensions that make the music of a Jewish life. And in today's chapter we learn something of those, of the management of those tensions. By Yosef or David has called the Yisrael Shloshim. All of David gathered 30,000 young men of Israel. By Yochum, by Yelich David, v'cholam asher ito. And David and this entire people, these 30,000 people, went with him. Nibale Yehuda, la'alis mishom es aron ha'elokim asher nigroshe shem Hashem tzmokos Yosef akruvim olav. To go and bring the Ark of God, which had been hiding, which had been put aside during all these years of turmoil and battle, and he wanted to now bring the ark up to his residence in Yerushalayim, which he had just conquered. They placed the ark of God. This is the same ark that was brought through the desert from Egypt. As they came from Egypt, it was made in the desert. They placed it on a brand new chariot, and they carried it from the house of Avinadov that was in Givo. The Uzo, the Achyo, Bnei Avinadov, and Uzo and Achyo, the sons of Avinadov, who had been protecting the ark up until this point, they were leading this chariot. So there were animals drawing the chariot, and they were leading it. They bore the ark out from the house of Avinadov, with the ark on top of it. The Achyo helech lifnei Aaron, and Achyo walked in front of it. The David, the whole base Yisrael, mesachakim lifnei Hashem, the whole atzei v'roshim. And David and all of the men of Israel, were dancing, were jolly in front of the ark. They were waving branches, they were playing musical instruments, there were drums and harps and violins, wind instruments, and all sorts of ringing instruments. It must have been a magnificent sight and sound. They came as far as Goyim Achorim. Vayishlach Uzo el Aron Elokim vayeches bo. Uzo put his arm out and took hold of the ark, kishomtu habocher, because the oxen that were drawing it let it slip, let it slide a little, and the ark was unstable, and Uzzah put his hand out to protect the ark. Hashem got angry with Uzzah, and he smote him there on the side of the road, and Uzzah died on the spot. Strange thing, he's trying to protect the ark is unstable, God gets angry and kills Uzzah instantaneously. What's that about? Chazal say why was David punished that in this time of great joy and celebration such a tragedy should take place? What happened? Explains Chazal Shekol Adivetor Zmirus Dichtiv Zmirus Hoyuli Chukecho. David, in one of his psalms, refers to the Torah as Zmirus. Zmirus are songs. So he refers to the Torah as song. In praise, he's saying, Zmirus O Yuli Chukecho, your laws, your statutes, O God, have been sung to me. That's how joyous I find them. That's such a terrible thing. God says to him, the words of Torah about which it is said that if you neglect them for a moment, they disappear. You've got to be constantly conscious of them. You call them song. I will cause you in public to make an error that even cheder children, little children in school, would know about, and you're going to make a mistake. And see the consequences of the mistake, and then tell me it's zmirus. Then tell me it's song. What's wrong with calling it song? What does that mean? It's interesting that he uses the word zmirus and not shir. God himself calls the Torah shir. The end of the Torah is called shir. There are many times that the Torah itself refers to itself as shir. Shir means song. And zmir means song. So God calls it Shira, and that's fine. David calls it Zmira, and he kills somebody for it. Why? What's so terrible about calling it Zmira? There's a difference between Zmira and Shira. Shira is poetry. Zmira is song. Poetry is not an easy sell. Song is. If I were to say to Rabbi Pogler, you know what, you told me the Monday night is a difficult sell. Fine, we won't have a shir next Monday night. We'll have a poetry reading session. Rabbi Pogler, is that going to be an easy sell? It's not going to be an easy sell. Who wants a poetry reading session? But if we say we're having music and dance, we'll fill the hall. It can be the same poetry, two music and dance. We'll get Jonathan Sadler to come with his guitar and to sing about subjects other than me, and we'll get everybody rocking and singing and dancing. We'll pack the place, and if it gets known that every Monday night that's what we do here, it will be packed. But will we be supplying Torah? No, we'll be competing with the other houses of entertainment, because people are willing on a Monday night when they're tired to be entertained, and that's what Zmira is. Zmira is the song acts on me. Shira is I sing. Shira is I create song. Shira is I create poetry and art. There's an enormous difference between entertainment and art. Art requires investment. Art requires thinking. Art requires feeling and emotion and experience. Entertainment requires nothing. Entertainment, it's all given to you. And people are willing to come to places that give them things. People are not that willing to come to places that ask them for things. And the problem with Shira as opposed to Zmira is Shira asks for your attention. Shira asks for our involvement. Shira asks for our thought process. Shira asks for our emotions. Zmira says, nothing, take it easy. It's interesting how easy people find it to spend money on therapy. but how they complain about spending the same amount of money on something that might do them a lot more good, but requires a lot more effort. Why? Therapy, I'll give it to you. Relax, take it easy, I'll give it to you. It doesn't require, unless one gets into really serious stuff, that much of a thought process of an investment of effort. It creates the sensation without the investment. It's part of the entertainment world. That's what it can be, and that's what it sometimes is. And so it is with Zmira. Zmira is entertainment, and God says, don't call the Torah entertainment, because the Torah is not entertaining. The Torah might be enjoyable. There might be joy and celebration in the Torah. But there is an enormous difference between joy and entertainment. There's an enormous difference between knowing how to enjoy oneself and how to be entertained. Very big difference. Being entertained, you put yourself in the hands of the entertainer. Enjoying oneself, you remain a master of your own emotions, of your own feelings. Very different. And so every cheder child knows, it's a pasuk in the Torah and Vayikra, that the way to carry the ark is on your shoulder. That's how God instructs the ark to be carried. Why does David put the ark on a wagon? The message he's giving subconsciously is, it's too heavy to carry. And that's why Uzzah puts his hand out and says, this is falling, this heavy thing, the Torah, the ark, it's falling, it needs support. And on that, Chazal tell us Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God said to Uzzah, Aron Mosei Es Mosov Atzmo Lekoshchem, the ark elevates those who carry it. Do you think it cannot carry itself? The people who carry the ark, it's too heavy a weight for people. It is too heavy. But when you invest in the Torah, it becomes light. That's what poetry is. If you read poetry without investment, if you just read it, it's boring, it's dull. If you indulge in art without investment, it leaves you with a heavy sense. But if you invest in the art, if you put some effort into the art, it elevates you, it uplifts you. If you learn Torah, and just you learn it, you read through it, without really applying yourself to it, it's heavy, it's difficult, it's problematic. If you apply yourself to it, it's enormously uplifting. It brings about a great deal of joy. The image that David creates by placing the ark, on a wagon is, this is too heavy to carry. Let's transport it on a wagon. So here we see, on the one hand, David is taught the lesson of referring to the Torah as light entertainment by making the mistake of treating it as something heavy and burdensome. Because the truth is, it's neither. It is neither heavy and burdensome and does not need to be carried on a wagon. It can be carried by people. But it cannot be carried by people who want to be entertained. People who wish to be entertained will find nothing of value in the Torah. There's better entertainment than the Torah. People who are people who carry it, people who take the responsibility of bearing the Torah, of investing in the Torah, of analyzing it, of thinking, of growing with it, of expanding and changing themselves with the Torah. Those people, Moses, for them it elevates them, it uplifts them. And so when I asked myself, and Rabbi Pogo said, the Monday night shiur is a hard sell, I had to say to myself, so why do, I don't know how many people are here tonight, we've got a very small crowd here tonight, but why do 50 or 60 or 70 or 80 people come on Monday night without selling? Really, it's no selling persons? Was anybody phoned and called and told to come? Were the advertisements out? Were the flyers out? No. So if it's a hard sell, why do more people come to this shiur than almost any other regular shiur in the town without selling? I had to ask myself, if it's so hard to sell. The answer is, it's hard to sell to people who want Zmiris, because this isn't Zmiris. And we don't want it to sell to people who want to put it on a cart. that to people who are willing to spend an hour thinking, for people who are willing to spend an hour taking themselves out of where they are and placing themselves in a different space and looking at their lives for 1 hour from a different perspective before they get back into their old lives again, for that it's a wonderful shiur. Any shiur, any Torah shiur where you really get into grips with the understanding of the essence of it is a wonderful opportunity to do that. And that's why those people who come find meaning in it. David learns his lesson. David is a quick learner, as we're going to see. He makes mistakes, but unlike Shaul, who makes the same mistakes over and over again, because they are mistakes generated by character flaw, David's mistakes are not generated by character flaw. They're generated by the process of living and learning. If you're going to live, you're going to learn, you're going to make an effort, you're going to get out there and you're going to try. There are two different philosophies in the technology world that some of you might be familiar with. The one is, perfect the new product before you put it onto the market, because you don't want a defective product on the market that will ruin your name. The other philosophy is, get them out, get it out onto the market, defective and all. You can do the best you can, but get it out and let people try it, and when it's working in the market, monitor the results and then pull it back and correct the defects and put another one out and monitor those and get it back and put another one out. Your laboratory is out there in the world. The one view is, your laboratory is in your company, perfect it in the laboratory and then put it out. The first view is, no, life is the laboratory. The real marketplace is the laboratory. There is no laboratory that can simulate all of those conditions. Get it out there and do it. Shaul was the perfectionist. He tried to perfect everything. He was a perfect person, as we know, before he started. But the problem with that is, if you do make a mistake, you perpetuate it forever, because you become fixed on the model that you regard as perfect. Whereas David, we see David's personality as we watch it develop, is out there. Let me try, let me go, let me experiment, let me explore. But the moment he steps wrong, and God advises him of that, there's an immediate alteration of David's behavior style. And so David learns very quickly that it was wrong to call it zmiris, it was wrong to call the Torah entertainment, song. It was wrong to place the Torah on the chariot. The Torah is neither a burden to be carried by a chariot, nor is it light entertainment. So what is it? David takes a while to analyze all this. He leaves the ark. The moment Uzzah dies, he stops the procession. There's a tragedy that has occurred. Vayeshev Aroin Hashem Beis Ovei Vedoi Magiti Shlosha Chodoshim. So the ark of God dwelt in the home of Oved Edom for 3 months. Vayevorech Hashem Es Oved Edom Ves Kol Beis Ovei. During that time, God brought enormous blessing to the household and the business of Oved Edom. Vayugad LaMelech David LeEmorim. The word came to King David saying, Beirach Hashem Es Beis Oved Edom Ves Kol Hashem Oved Bavur Arena Elokim. God has given great blessing to Oved Edom because of the Ark of God. Vayevech David Vayales Arena Elokim Beis Oved Edom. David Besimcha. So David went that time back 3 months after the tragedy to the house of Oved Edom to complete the journey of the ark and bring it up to Ir David. Ir David was David's residence in the city of Jerusalem. And this second procession was an even more, one of even greater celebration than the earlier one. But on this occasion, the ark was carried on the shoulders of those who carried it. They walked 6 steps and they sacrificed an ox and a lamb, and another 6 and they would sacrifice. This was a major procession. But David mecharkeh b'chol oiz lifnei Hashem, and David danced with all his might before God. The David hagur eifed bad, and David was clothed in a cotton or linen tunic. David the whole base Israel, and David and all the Jews, all the people of Israel, were bringing the Ark of God up with blowing of shofar and with music. And it was as this procession with the Ark of God was approaching the city of David, Michal bas Shaul nishkefo ba'adach halon. And Michal, one of David's most beloved wives, if not the most beloved wife, David had several, we remember at the stage already, but Michal was really central to David's life at the stage. Michal is looking out of the window, watching the procession. Vatere es hamelech David mefazez mechalkel lifnei Hashem. And she looks at the king, David. First time in this chapter is called Hamelech David. I don't know, it's David, David. This time she looks, and she looks at the king, David, her husband, jumping and dancing and somersaulting before God. Vatives loy beliba. And she was disgusted with him in her heart. She lost respect for him. Vayaviras Hared Hashem, and they brought the Ark of Hashem, brought sacrifices. And when all the sacrificing and the celebration was over, David blessed the people in the name of God, gave them food to eat. Each of them went to their home. Batetze Michal Bashol Likras David, and Michal Bas David, Michal Bashol reminds us that Michal was the daughter of Shaul, the wife of David, comes out to meet him, Batomer, and listen to her greeting. As her husband, tired, exhausted, but exhilarated from the success of a celebratory day of finally bringing the ark to rest in Yerushalayim, making Yerushalayim the religious capital not only of the Jewish people but of the world, she says to him, "Ma nichbad hayo melech Yisrael. Indeed, what a glorious day, O King of Israel. Hashem niglo hayom le'enei amhois avodov. Ki galois niglo achad harekim. A king of Israel who revealed himself to the women of the street as one of the cheap bartenders might have done. That's what you looked like." And David's answer to Michal, listen to the force of a king. And don't forget, David is from the tribe of Yehuda. David, as we will see and have seen, is not afraid to say, "I'm sorry, I've done wrong." That's one of David's strengths. We talked about that as one of the powers of Malchus, of majesty, is the ability to say, "I'm sorry," in a way that really communicates that. David's not afraid to do that. What does David say here? Now you met David or Michal, and David says to Michal, "Lifnei Hashem asher bochal bi me'ovicho michol beso, betzavoyso si nogid al Hashem al Yisrael, besichakti lifnei Hashem." Yes, in the presence of the God who chose me over your father to be the king of Israel, I rejoiced and I danced and I played before that God. Veniklesi oid bizos. And if you think you've seen anything yet, you've seen nothing yet. I'm going to get even cheaper than that. V'hoyisi shafal be'enai. I will get to the point where I'm disgraceful in my own eyes. But about the maidservants you talk about, the spectators, I will be considered honorable in their eyes. You don't understand, Michal. You don't understand how they see me, and you don't understand how I see myself, and you're making a very flawed comparison between me and your father. I want to spend the rest of the shiur analyzing that comparison. There is another paradox. A paradox between kovod, dignity, on the one hand, and simcha, true joy, on the other hand. And that is the paradox that Michal is concerned about. She sees a conflict between joy and dignity. She sees loss of dignity in true celebration. The Gemara Yerushalmi, in fact, embellishes, gives us the background of what she really said to David. She said more than is recorded in the Tanakh. She says the following. Amrulu, she said to him, Mishpachto shel beis abo, hoysa noe minach. My father's family was far more noble than you. Chalil olohem shenire meyemeyem, pisas yad u pisas regel ve'ekev migulim. Chas v'sholem, it would have been a terrible thing to any of them had they revealed their hand or their ankle. They were always meticulously dressed and properly covered. And whether they were dancing at a simcha or they weren't, you would never see any part of their body uncovered that was normally covered. You wouldn't see anybody of my father's household in shorts, walking around with sandals, without socks. Wouldn't happen. You certainly wouldn't see him in a swimming costume. And you certainly wouldn't see him dancing around in such a way that he loses the dignity of his dress. My father's whole household were more honorable than yours. Than you. David, and what was in David's answer? He says, "Beisavicha you mevakshim kovod atzman u'menichim kovod shemayim." You're right. Your father's household was exemplary in honor, but it was in the honor of themselves that they were exemplary, and they ignored the honor of God. V'ani eini oseh kein elo meniach ani kovod atzmi mevakesh ani kovod shemayim. I abandon my own dignity so as to exalt God. I don't care what I look like when I'm busy praising God. I'm not conscious of what I look like in the press. I'm not conscious of what I'm going to look like on TV. I'm so involved and indulged in Hashem that I totally forget myself. So yes, there is more dignity in Shaul than there is in me. But there is more dignity in God when I'm dancing than there is in God when Shaul is protecting his own dignity. Now let's understand this and examine this. What does dignity mean? Dignity is a very important concept. It's important in the Torah, it's important in civilization, it is the essence of civilization. Dignity is the capacity of the human being to project majesty. Almost any human being can project majesty. Not just project nobility, he can project majesty. But to project majesty, he cannot be himself. If you're not a king, so if you're going to project majesty, you've got to act like a king. You've got to dress like a king, bear yourself like a king, speak like a king, and act like a king. But if you do that, you can project majesty. Now I ask myself sometimes, I ask a lot of interesting questions of myself sometimes. One interesting question I ask of myself is, what am I doing in Los Angeles? Why did God put me here? Why here? There are other places. It's a beautiful place to be, lovely people. But there are other beautiful places with lovely people. Why here? What am I meant to learn here that you cannot learn anywhere else in the world? I'm a little bit reluctant to tell you what that is, because if I've learnt it, God might take me somewhere else and I'm enjoying it here. But I think one of the things that God teaches here is the greatness of the emptiness and smallness of the entertainers. And that sounds paradoxical. The big stars, the mega earners, I'm sure some of them are very nice people, some of them probably very intelligent, but not to the level of the kind of earnings we're talking about in terms of the contribution they make to civilization. So what is the lesson? The lesson is, and I'm not referring to any specific person, and any reference is purely fictitious and all of that stuff. And nobody can project majesty. An actor, the ability, the capability of a human being to embody something a million times bigger than he is and to project that is what we see from that. You don't have to be a king to project majesty. That's the art of acting. The art of acting is you can project anything, including the highest levels of human civilization, if you know how to do it and you've got the props. It can be done. And acting isn't just about artificiality. Acting is about communicating. Acting is about creating an atmosphere and communicating, creating a real atmosphere. It's true that the event isn't real, but the atmosphere is real. To be able to get people to feel something, that's real. They use illusion, but the art is not illusion. The feelings they create are real. And many of them are unintelligent. What does that teach us? You don't have to be a king to project majesty. You have to act like a king to project majesty. You don't have to be a professor to project wisdom. You have to act like a professor to project wisdom. And the human being, one of the human being's greatest godly gifts is the ability to act. And I'm using act not in its negative sense at all, but in its artistic sense. The ability of the human being to embody a part, a role, bigger than himself. Get into that role in the most convincing way. And the only way he can convince an audience is if he feels himself in that role himself. So during the period of his acting, the hour or 2 hours that he's on that stage, he is that part. The ability of the human being to put himself into clothing that is much bigger than him and experience and be that for a period of time. So much so that he can convince others and make them feel as if he's that. That's something only humans can do. Animals can't act. They cannot be something they're not. We think sometimes the greatest human achievement is to be yourself. No, a monkey can be itself. That's all a monkey can do, is be itself. The greatest human achievement is to be not yourself. To be able to be anything you choose. To be able to be anyone you choose, almost. For periods of time. To be able to sense, to taste majesty, although you're not a king. To be able to create an environment of majesty, although you don't have a palace. A human being can do that. That's dignity. Is it dignified to be dressed in a tuxedo? Beautifully dressed, women in long gowns, and an important event? Of course that's dignified. Is it natural? No, natural would be to come with no clothes. It's the opposite of natural. Dignity is the opposite of natural. Dignity is transcending the natural. And through projecting oneself and through the sense of drama, being able to create a feeling, a sensation of something bigger than we are. To be able to access something bigger than we are. Now, I'm going to suggest one step further, and that is that we would not be able to do that convincingly if there wasn't something of it in us. If there wasn't inherent majesty in a human being, if a human being was not created in the image of God, he wouldn't be able to carry off the act. If there wasn't a touch of wisdom, a spark of wisdom in a person, he wouldn't be able to act wise. If there wasn't a touch of humor in a person, he wouldn't be able to act the clown. We can magnify what we are. We can take a spark of what we are, and for short periods of time, we can magnify that. And dignity is to take the majesty of the spark of God that there is inside us, to expand that, and to project that majesty in a way that creates a sense of the bigness of our souls rather than the limitations of our bodies. Because that's where majesty lies. Majesty is in the spirit, not in the physical. And Michal saw that in Shaul every day of Shaul's life. Shaul embodied majesty all the time. You never caught Shaul off mark. You never caught Shaul napping in that sense. Do you remember when Shaul had to relieve himself? Where he went? So that it should in no way compromise the way he's perceived, the majesty with which he's perceived. Is it natural to relieve oneself? Of course it is. Does everybody know he does it? Of course they do. But it would spoil the show. It would spoil the majesty. There are certain things that you don't do in public. Nothing wrong with them. Nothing to be ashamed of. But it diminishes the projected image of majesty if that's what one is busy projecting. And Michal says to David, you've blown your part. You're a king. Don't you realize you're supposed to act king? And you're dancing in the street like a light kid, entertaining people? What do you think you look like? They'll always have in their image this man doing cartwheels in the street. They'll never think of you as a king again. They'll never imagine you as a king again. You've destroyed the majesty of your role. And David says, that's what you don't understand. A human being's role is to project God's majesty, not their own. Your father was a master at the projection of majesty, and that's why he lost the... Yeah. You've got to be able to go from the majestic to the natural as well. The difficulty with that, with losing oneself from the natural, is when a person loses themselves, what are they? When a person projects the majestic, projects the spirituality of his godliness, the majesty of his godliness, you realize what he is a human being projecting majesty. But what's when he lets himself go? When he decides to be completely natural, drops all the masks, drops all the props, just going to be myself. What is it? That's when the danger exists, and when a human being can find himself in an environment that he cannot risk that. And we very seldom risk it. Unless we're drunk, we don't drop the act. We drop a little bit of the act if we're with people that we're comfortable with. If we're with people that we're very comfortable with, we drop a little bit more of the act. But unless we're with people that we're totally intimate with, we would never drop the entire act. We're always acting a little bit. Because it's not safe to drop the entire act. Michal is right. People are left with that image. You lower yourself to the lowest common denominator of your existence, and that's who you are naturally. Unless we can create an environment in which it's safe to drop the act. Because in losing yourself, you become something else, something bigger than you. So for example, people use music for that. If you get into really rhythmic music, what are you doing? You're losing yourself into the music. So what governs your movement? The act is gone. You are no longer consciously directing the movement of your limbs. What is directing the movement of your limbs? The music is directing the movement of your limbs. So you've lost yourself to the music. If the music is raucous and vulgar, your movements will be raucous and vulgar. If the movements are elegant and harmonious, your movements will be elegant and harmonious. You have dropped your own mask and adopted and completely merged yourself into something bigger than you, the sound, the music. What David refers to is the capacity of a human being to merge himself into the environment of sanctity. That when you're in the presence of godliness, that's the time to drop the mask. The time to put the mask on is when you're not in the presence of godliness, and you have to project the godliness because there's no godliness around you. So if you're walking in the streets of Los Angeles, that's not a time to lose yourself. That's a time to project dignity, because there isn't that much around you. But if you're in the Beis HaMikdash, if you're in the temple, with godliness surrounding you all the time, that's the time to lose yourself. You don't have to project dignity. There's dignity all around you, better dignity than you. Now your task is to lose yourself and become part of that which is around you, not become separated from that which is around you. And your father, David says to Michal, was a master at projecting dignity, but could never lose himself even to God. And what you saw me today was losing myself to the point where I became nothing. Shafal be'enai. In my own eyes, I'm nothing. That's what it's all about. I'm unimportant in my own eyes, because I'm completely merged into the atmosphere and the being of God himself. The Rambam defines this at the end of Hilchos Lulav, and he says, the end of the laws of Sukkah, and he says the following, Hasimcho shivismach odon da'asiyas ha-mitzvah v'ahavas ha-ker shitzivo behem, the joy, the celebration of doing a mitzvah. So this is the other side of the coin. Yeah, Judaism is heavy in their mitzvahs and there are all sorts of things one has to do, but the joy that one experiences in the doing of a mitzvah, with Ava Sokel Shitzibo Bohem, and in the love of God who commanded us in these mitzvahs, Avoda Gedolohi. This is a great service. It's an incredibly important part of Jewish life. And anybody who holds himself back from the joy and celebration of Jewish life, You have to pay for it. And anybody who becomes arrogant and self-conscious and conscious about his own dignity when he's meant to be letting himself go in such celebration, he is a sinner and he's foolish. There's an unintelligence about it, there's a lack of intelligence, there's a pompousness about it, and pompousness is unintelligent, and there's sin involved. The chol ha-mashpil atzmo, and anybody who lowers himself, in mekel gufo, and he lightens his body. Exactly those words. He lets his body go. Lightens his body. In these places. Hu ha-godol ha-mechubod. He is the great, dignified human being. To be able to lose yourself when you're surrounded by dignity, in the same way that you can create dignity when you're surrounded by looseness, that's the management of the paradox. To be able to do the one without the other is no kunst, that's no art. And so if we're going to say that dignity is accessing the majesty in the natural, then joy is being able to access the natural in the majesty. To be able to find majesty and be yourself in that majesty. To be able to release yourself and be yourself. And the areas that we have it today are not that many, because we don't have those levels of sanctity and of dignity. Perhaps one of the only areas that one has it today, one has it to some degree in simchas, if there's a proper joyous occasion, but we'd have to be where there's real sanctity at a simcha. That's not easy to find. And the other is where there's intimacy between husband and wife. Are times where there is sanctity, and one is meant to find the naturalness of that sanctity. Because a man and a woman's relationship is perhaps the clearest example in day-to-day life of the awe and the joy being merged. Where we say that God is a party to that relationship, that God is part of the creative process, that God is part of the intimacy between a man and a woman. So what are you supposed to do? Does that mean that you've got to drag your chest and put your talus and tefillin on? No. It's a time of one's life where one is not only permitted but required to be able to release oneself, to be able to let oneself go. Because in that majesty there is able and needing to be complete naturalness. One has to be able to balance them both. One has to be able to be dignified when there is looseness, and to be loose when there is dignity. And what happens as a result of Michal's very harsh criticism and unfounded criticism of David? We're told in the last verse of the chapter, Michal Bashol, the Horelo Yeled Ad Yomoso. Michal Bashol could no longer have any children until the day of her death. As a result of this, she was never able, whether it's to gain that kind of intimacy with David, whether it was to be able to produce a child, whether it was natural or unnatural, until the day of her death. She did have a baby on the day of her death. That was the next time that she gave birth. That was the next time she was able to give birth. And the Torah links that tragic sadness to her incapacity of understanding and her harsh dealing with David, in this stark contrast between two gigantic figures of Jewish life. The man who knew how to project dignity and majesty in everything he did, and the man who knew how to be himself in every situation in which he found himself. Shaul, our first king, and David, our second. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Rabbi Pogo has some announcements to make.